The Tom Woods Show, episode 428. Peter Schiff's gold company, Schiff Gold, is holding a special sweepstakes just for Tom Woods Show listeners. They're giving away a 1 ounce gold coin worth about $1,200. Enter for free at tomwoods.com/gold.
In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. What a thrill it is to be joined once again by the great and heroic Walter Williams. Walter Williams teaches economics at George Mason University. He is the author of 10 books, including The State Against Blacks, Up from the Projects, an autobiography, and Race and Economics, How Much Can Be Blamed on Discrimination. Professor Williams is a nationally syndicated columnist. He has many, many credentials he can boast. We're talking today about his new book, American Contempt for Liberty. All the titles I just mentioned will be linked on today's show notes page, which is tomwoods.com/428. Professor Williams, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you very much, Tom.
Your book is called American Contempt for Liberty, one of the bluntest book titles I've ever encountered. What do you mean, American Contempt for Liberty? Referring to the government, to the general public, to particular pressure groups? What do you have in mind there?
Well, I'm talking about the general public. Here's where I start. I say that I am my private property. I belong to Walter Williams, and Tom Woods belongs to Tom Woods. And so when you start off with the idea of self-ownership and self-private property, well, certain acts become moral and certain acts are immoral. That is, the reason why murder is immoral is because it violates private property. Rape is immoral because it violates private property. Theft is immoral because it violates private property. And to forcibly use one American to serve the purposes of another is also immoral. But most Americans believe that it is okay for the government to forcibly use one American to serve the purposes of another. That is, they forcibly use you and me to serve the purposes of farmers. That is, they give farmers, they make us work, give up some of our income so that farmers can have crop subsidies or to bail out banks and businesses or to give welfare payments to poor people, to give foreign aid to different countries. And so, but most Americans believe that that is okay. They find nothing wrong with the government forcibly using one person to serve the purpose of another. And I might just add that the forcible use of one person to serve a purpose of another is a fairly good operational definition of slavery.
Well, that's a controversial way of putting it, of course. If you were to say that, you'd be accused of gross insensitivity. Well, I'm sure you have been. You're Walter Williams, after all.
That's right. Now, when I say that I don't believe that one American has the right to live at the expense of another American, or that government should not use one American to serve the purposes of another, that does not mean that I do not believe that in helping our fellow man in need. But I believe that helping one's fellow man in need by reaching into one's own pockets to do so, I think it's praiseworthy and laudable. Helping one's fellow man in need by reaching into somebody else's pockets to do so, I think it's worthy of condemnation. It's despicable. And matter of fact, it's just simply a theft. It's legalized theft.
Your book is a collection of columns of yours from over the years, and I don't want to make you feel old, but I've been reading your columns since I was in high school, and it's great to have them collected in this way, and you've organized them into categories. You've got a section on the Constitution, on education, on racial issues, and general economic issues, and the environment, and so on. So it's almost anything you'd want to know about is in here. So let's start with a basic economic issue, and that's the issue of government spending and debt. What's wrong with the argument that, look, we've had a substantial national debt for quite some time now, and there don't seem to be any real ill effects? So people who complain about it are just sky is falling, incorrigible doomsayers, and we really should disregard them.
Well, I think that one of the things about national debt is just one way of concealing the activity of government. That is, people say, well, gee, we have to worry about the debt being imposed on future generations. Well, I don't think that that's true at all. That is, if the federal government spends $4 trillion this year, well, then of necessity, it must force us, you and me, to spend $4 trillion less. Now, there are three ways that the government can do this. One, they can tax us to get us to spend less of what we produce. Number two, they can enter the bond market to get us to spend less of what we produce. That is, and drive up the interest rates and reduce investment activities. And then finally, they can just inflate the currency. So the national debt really reflects current spending. And a lot of people say, this will be a burden on our future generations. I say, well, so what? Future generations haven't done anything for me. Why not burden them? But the fact of business is that the federal government cannot spend what is produced in 2030 or 2050. They can only spend what is produced in 2015.
Now, speaking of debt, of course, there's a form of debt that we read about an awful lot in the paper, and that is the increasing educational debt, college debt that young people are incurring. And you have a chapter in here, a section called Too Much College. I think people can probably anticipate what the argument is there, which I'd like to hear you reproduce. But then I'd like to hear you answer, well, look, that's easy for Walter Williams to say. He's got a PhD from, I think it's UCLA. Of course, it's easy for you to say other people don't need college. Your career was made possible by it. So what do we mean when we say that there's too much college?
Well, first of all, there are people in college who should not be in college.
That you don't say.
That's right. It turns out that I think it's approximately 50% of incoming freshmen on colleges across the United States. They need remedial math, remedial English, and remedial writing. And so this says that they've gotten fraudulent high school diplomas that give them the impression that they're college ready, when in fact they're not college ready. So these people should not be on college campuses. Another way of looking at it is that I've gone to the library like 10 o'clock in the morning, walk across the field to the library, and I might see, you know, 10, 15 kids out there throwing frisbee. And then I come back maybe 2 hours, 3 hours later, the same kids are out there throwing a frisbee. Well, that's not the purpose of college. They do better, having a job at McDonald's and kind of preparing themselves for the future. And then also, I tell people that had I gone to college right after high school, it would have been an unmitigated disaster because I was immature, I was not ready for college, and I would have just flunked out. And when I did start college, I was a full-grown, I was 25 years old, having been in the Army and also married. So I would take college seriously. But a lot of kids, they're not ready for college, in my opinion. And then also, I have this, get this from the fact that I've been teaching for 45 years, and you look at some of the work and some of the attitudes of many students, again, they should be out getting a job. And then maybe if they gain some maturity and a better outlook on life, and then maybe they should go to college. But many to kids 17, 18 years old, they should be, you know, getting a job at McDonald's.
I'm looking at the table of contents here for the education section. Let me just read four chapter titles. These are just back-to-back chapter titles for the audience, for them to get a sense of what they can find in your book, American Contempt for Liberty. One of them is Educational Lunacy. Next chapter, Academic Dishonesty. Next chapter, Dishonest Educators. And next chapter, Academic Cesspools. You have some iconoclastic views on education. Share some of them with us.
Well, one of the problems with college education is the very fact that the education schools of education on college campuses represent the intellectual slums of almost any college. And I mean, the students who take education courses that are perhaps the lowest SAT scores of any other students, students majoring in any other field. And then also they have, when they graduate and decide, well, maybe they want to go to law school or go to medical school, they have the lowest LSAT and lowest MCAT scores. And these people, they go through college and get A's and B's. And so so it suggests that that there's some something doesn't smell well in Denmark.
I want to ask you, if I may, a few questions about the section of your book dealing with race. And I wonder, first of all, if it annoys you that you're a professional economist, and on your professional page at GMU, I think, I don't know if it's still there, but I remember years ago looking on your professional page, and I could actually see tests that you had given or study questions or something, and they were all extremely difficult technical questions in economics. Does it annoy you that here you are, a PhD economist, and you can speak on all manner of questions, and yet everybody always wants to ask you about race?
Well, it annoys me a little bit, but I can understand it because my ideas on race differ in a significant degree from many other people's ideas on race, and particularly black people.
And also, of course, you have written books on the subject, so it's not like they're just saying, well, we have a black economist on, so we have to talk about that subject. You have written on it, but I feel a little bit guilty bringing this up. But
No. I think that issues of race need to be discussed intelligently in our country, and we need to move away from the feel good rhetoric that people use about race. And then there's certain things that many people find politically incorrect to say, but they need to be said.
It seems to me that the people who say we need to have a national conversation on race really have in mind we should have a national hectoring monologue on race, and nobody should dare to contradict what's said by the hectoring soliloquists, in effect. Now, I want to ask you what your view of this currently trendy idea called white privilege is, that there's white privilege that somebody like me has that people who are non-white don't have, and that helps to account for why I'm successful and they're not.
Well, that was part of a subject of a recent column, and I point out that white privilege can't be based on income, and the reason why is that Asian American households have the highest median income in our country. They have $68,000, and white median household income is $57,000, and so maybe we should be talking about Asian privilege. But I think white privilege or privilege has become the new term for achievement. That is, when people who achieve, they're said to have privilege. And I doubt whether privilege can explain much of what we see anywhere.
Well, I think one way to evaluate the claim would be to ask, if there really is a racial hierarchy in terms of privilege, then think about what happens when it comes time to apply for college. What race would you want to pretend to be on your application? If there really were white privilege, everybody would want to pretend to be white. But nobody in his right mind wants to pretend to be white.
And you don't want to pretend to be Asian either.
Oh, you definitely, because forget it. Good luck. Good luck there. Professor Williams, let's pause for a moment and thank our sponsor. Hey, everybody. I'm excited to announce that Schiff Gold, Peter Schiff's gold company, is holding a sweepstakes exclusively for Tom Woods Show listeners, and they're giving away a 1 ounce Canadian gold maple leaf coin worth about $1,200. Costs nothing to enter, which you can do at tomwoods.com/gold. As I've told you before, I use Schiff Gold for all my precious metal purchases because I know they're reliable, and I know that anybody who works for Peter Schiff is going to be knowledgeable, and I know my experience is going to be efficient and pleasant, and it always is with Schiff Gold. And incidentally, they have among the most loyal and satisfied customers among major gold dealers. It turns out that over 60% of Schiff Gold's first-time customers go on to make additional purchases. This is virtually unheard of in the industry. Right now, though, throw your name into the hat. You don't have to buy anything to enter over at tomwoods.com/gold. I'll announce the winner on this show on episode 446. It's going to be exciting. I want to read for people, if I may, this is, I don't think in the book, but it is just classic Walter Williams fare. And I will link to it. Today's show notes page is tomwoods.com/428. This being episode 428. We'll, of course, link to your book there, but I hope you'll just pardon me if I read to people, well, pardon me, interesting choice of words here, if I read for people your proclamation of amnesty and pardon granted to all persons of European descent. It takes just a moment. Whereas Europeans kept my forebears in bondage some three centuries, toiling without pay. Whereas Europeans ignored the human rights pledges of the Declaration of Independence and the United States Constitution. Whereas the Emancipation Proclamation, the 13th and 14th Amendments meant little more than empty words. Therefore, Americans of European ancestry are guilty of great crimes against my ancestors and their progeny. But in the recognition Europeans themselves have been victims of various and sundry human rights violations, to wit, the Norman conquest, the Irish potato famine, decline of the Habsburg dynasty, Napoleonic and Tsarist adventurism, and gratuitous insults and speculations about the intelligence of Europeans of Polish descent, I, Walter E. Williams, do declare full and general amnesty and pardon to all persons of European ancestry for both their own grievances and those of their forebears against my people. Therefore, from this day forward, Americans of European ancestry can stand straight and proud, knowing they are without guilt, and thus obliged not to act like damn fools in their relationships with Americans of African ancestry. Signed, Walter E. Williams, gracious and generous grantor. Do you have any comment looking back on that today?
Well, I said that back when I was a professor of economics at Temple University. This was in the 70s.
That old? Really?
Oh, yes. And I didn't put it up on a website because websites weren't available.
Well, of course.
but anyway, it came up because my first year at Temple University, the debate in our department, economics department, is whether we should have a class on black economics, because some students were demanding, black students were demanding black economics. And so I was asking my colleagues, well, how do demand curves and the supply curves slope and behave for black people as opposed to white people? And they couldn't come up with any answers. And so during a department meeting, I told them that if some Irish students came demanding Irish economics or Polish economics or Italian economics or Chinese economics, they would throw these students out of their office. It's nonsense, but because of their guilt, they would entertain the idea of black students demanding these ideas. So that's during the department meeting. I just told them that I wanted to declare full and general amnesty, give them full and general amnesty for their own grievances and those of their forebears against my people, so that they would stop feeling guilty and stop acting like damn fools. And anyway, shortly after the meeting, I said some other things to my colleagues. I had one colleague, he was a dear friend of mine, white guy, and he told me in confidence in the hallway one day, he said, "Walter, don't think that your colleagues don't like you because you're black." He says, "People wouldn't like you even if you were white."
Well, in some way, that's kind of a comfort, I suppose, right? Let me read a passage from page 163 of your book and get your thoughts. "The fact that black parents, teachers, politicians, and civil rights organizations tolerate and make excuses for the despicable and destructive behavior of so many young blacks is a gross betrayal of the memory, struggle, sacrifice, sweat, and blood of our ancestors. The sorry and tragic state of black education is not going to be turned around until there's a change in what's acceptable and unacceptable behavior by young people. That change has to come from within the black community." Well, that's, I mean, no one's allowed to say that. You're not even allowed to say that, although here you go saying it.
Well, one of the reasons I say these things is because I have a rich physical endowment, and that forestalls a lot of fear that I might have. Then plus, I have a concealed carry permit as well. But I think that's absolutely true. I think that what goes on in our schools and what goes on in many black neighborhoods, it represents a betrayal to the sacrifices in blood, sweat, and tears of black people who fought in the civil rights movement. That is, if you look at what goes on in some of our schools, predominantly black schools, where teachers are assaulted. Kids are fighting for one another. They're not learning. They're saying, if you speak properly, you're acting white, and all this kind of nonsense. I mean, I think that the people who died in the civil rights struggle, who are now dead, many of them, they're old and they're dead. They died in the 50s or 60s. They would be turning in their graves if they knew what was going on today. And then also, what a lot of Americans don't, what many Americans don't appreciate, is that many of the things that you see, that we've seen in places like Ferguson and Baltimore and New York, many of the things that you see among black people are entirely new. Among black people, that is, the illegitimacy rate among blacks is 72%. But however, in 1938, the illegitimacy rate among blacks was 11%. Today, only one third of black kids live in two-parent families. In 1880, as I write in my book Race and Economics, in 1880, depending on the city, 70 to 80% of black kids lived in two-parent families. And 1925, 85% of kids in Harlem, New York lived in two-parent families. And so, and the murder rate that you see, the crime and violence that you see, is again entirely new. I grew up in the Richard Allen Housing Project in North Philadelphia, and we didn't go to bed with the sounds of gunshots. Matter of fact, one of the habits was that the people didn't lock their doors until the last person came in at night, and there was far greater security. And all this was at a time when there was far greater racial discrimination in the United States and fewer opportunities for blacks. And I'm almost 80 years old, so I was growing up at the time, at the 40s and 50s in North Philadelphia, and it was entirely different. But most white people and people looking, maybe most black people, they don't realize that what we're seeing today, the pathology that we're seeing in black communities, is entirely new. And so we have to ask the question, well, what might explain it? And I think a lot of it can be explained by the welfare system.
Of course, the traditional explanations that we're going to be given as to why these problems exist, that there's racism and discrimination and so forth, are extremely unsatisfactory because of exactly the reasons you've given. Well, then why were the problems that we're seeing so much less pronounced at a time when those issues were so much more intense? So that's why they have to dig around for institutional racism or whatever, because they can't face that question. If there's a modern problem that we didn't have X number of years ago, there must be a modern explanation. And any modern explanation is going to implicate the very people who are the biggest loudmouths about it. So they have to deflect and misdirect people.
And some people say it's the legacy of slavery. And my response to that, well, the legacy of slavery must have a way of skipping some generations.
Yeah, right. All of a sudden we're feeling it, even though we hadn't felt it in the interim quite so much. I remember back in the early 1990s, you were subbing for Rush Limbaugh one day, and you made a comment about the admission practices at Harvard Medical School, and you said that there was a racially disparate standards applied, and that black students were being accepted who didn't have the same level of achievement that the other students had, and that what this was doing was tainting them in their careers, because people would just assume that they had gotten in with lower standards, and so this would make them their professional credential suspect from now on. Well, you got taken behind the woodshed, or at least verbally, by the dean of Harvard Medical School, who called you a racist for saying it. So I was a budding young little, I didn't eventually become a journalist, but I wrote when I was in college, and I called him up. I was at Harvard at the time, and I called him up and said, I just thought it might be an interesting detail that, Walter Williams is black. And he came back with the usual, he's obviously a self-hating black person, and so on and so forth. So I contacted you about this. This is so long ago, you probably don't remember, but I told you what was going on. I said, I'm going to write an article about this, and you offered to send a photograph of yourself. Like, you really wanted to stick it to these people. And sure enough, we did that. So that, it's at least I do feel like these days, on the one hand, you get condemned and smeared if you say the wrong thing. But on the other hand, with the internet, a lot of times when people will, if you write a truth-telling article, not just on this, but on a lot of taboo subjects, you look at the comments section, and it's 90% favorable. Like there's a lot of people in the country who are tired of being muzzled, and when they see somebody exercising a little bit of independent judgment, they are very happy to run to that person's defense.
Oh, yes, and I've had, when I was at Temple University, I've had colleagues come and tell me that they support me, but they don't want to give their name.
Yeah, exactly.
That is, they rather do it, anonymously.
Yeah, God bless America. Yeah.
And so one of my responses is that that white people need to get some backbone and stop feeling guilty about. But on the other hand, it's unkind of me to say it that way because. That, you know, they're like if white people say certain things, they can lose their job, they can lose their promotion, and so who am I to suggest that they take such a risk? And I mean, it's a lot of times it's just easier to remain silent. But and it would have been easier for me. But I tell people that they say, "Oh, Walter, you're so brave." I say, "Well, no, I'm not really brave. It's that I have a highly diversified sources of income." That is, my income comes from a number of different sources, and when your income comes from a number of different sources, you can tell any two or three of them to go to hell.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Well, listen, before we wrap up, I want to ask you just one thing about the last section of your book is some miscellaneous topics. And I remember Thomas Sowell saying something along the lines that somebody can put in a bumper sticker a fallacy that would take paragraphs to refute. And that's the problem that economists face, that you can come up with a dumb guy economic fallacy in five words, but it's going to take me five paragraphs to refute. So I'm at a little bit of a competitive disadvantage. And so just looking over your book, one of your chapters is a response to the old claim, we need people before profits, and your chapter title is called Profits Are for People. So how do you answer that typical argument?
Well, my response, I think, is kind of simple. You say, well, look at the areas of our lives where there's the greatest discontent in the where there's the greatest discontent and their marches and their petitions and stuff like this. Well, it turns out to be that people are dissatisfied with the postal service. They're dissatisfied with public schools. They're dissatisfied with the motor vehicles department. Where are people most satisfied? And you never see people in the conflict. Well, it's the supermarkets. It's the computer store. It's the clothing store. And what's the difference between these two areas where people are very satisfied and people are dissatisfied? And I think it's very interesting. I think it's very easy. And that is where people are, those areas of our lives where people are most dissatisfied are the nonprofit areas, such as the police, the schools, the motor vehicle department, the post office. Where they're the most satisfied are the profit-making areas where people are, you know, the owners are after profits, and such as the computer stores, the supermarkets, and clothing stores. And so profits force the people who are in charge to pay attention to the wishes of the people. When there are no profits, the people can keep their jobs and not pay attention to the wishes of the people. That is, if a supermarket conducted its business the way public schools do, it would be out of business. But see, public schools know that, they have a monopoly and parents don't have much choice. The same thing with the motor vehicles department and the post office. By the way, the post office is becoming much better behaved since they have so much more competition nowadays.
Oh, yeah, isn't that the truth? Well, the book we've been discussing is American Contempt for Liberty by our guest Walter Williams. You can check it out at tomwoods.com/428. We'll also be linking to the proclamation of amnesty and pardon, and we'll link to Professor Williams' previous appearance on the program when we talked about possibly even a hotter subject. We talked about secession and other things of that sort, so check that out at tomwoods.com/428. Professor Williams, thanks so much, as always, for your time today.
And thank you very much, Tom. Keep up the good work.
All right, everybody, a couple of freebies I want to tell you about. I've just produced another free ebook for you guys, and it is called Start Your Blog or Website Today, resources for people too busy to learn programming or design. If you've been saying to yourself that you really should start a blog, for example, then this little ebook, which costs you nothing, you don't even have to join my mailing list to get it, it really is free, will help you. It takes you step by step through how it's done. You'll be up and running, I am not joking, in 5 minutes. And then beyond that, it's got all kinds of tricks and tips that I use. So check it out at freewebsitebook.com. For example, it tells you how to start and build a mailing list so that people who come to your website or come to your blog will come back. You'll be able to reach them and say, hey, I've got more content. That's a very important way to drive traffic to your site and to drive sales if you're trying to sell something. I show you in this book how it's possible for me to say on this show, go ahead and subscribe to my weekly letter and get my free ebook, 14 Hard Questions for Libertarians Answered, by texting the word Liberty to 33444. Wouldn't you like to know how to do that? Because I can get up and give a speech in front of a big audience. They've all got their cell phones, and I can get people to join my mailing list, which I send, you know, one email a week. And by the way, the email I send, one of the things it does is it tells you every episode that's coming up in the following week, so you can be really ahead of the game. Plus, it's got my usual tips and interesting news items and so on. But I can say to people, you can get that plus my free ebook by just texting the word Liberty to 33444. Or if you're a podcaster like me, you're doing a podcast, most people are out and about when they're listening to your podcast. They're not sitting at a computer where they can do stuff, but they've got their cell phones. You tell them to text something, they can go ahead and text it. You can build your email list, and that's what drives, a lot of times, repeat traffic back to your site. Or even simple things like, how do I come up with a good domain name, a .com domain name, when it seems like all of them are taken? I give you some tips for coming up with really great domain names, plus all kinds of plugins that I've used that have worked for me, all kinds of recommendations that you can use, plus, of course, discount codes throughout to help you save some money as you do this. So definitely check that out at freewebsitebook.com. Remember, too, that the Great Shift Gold Sweepstakes ends July 13th, 2015 at midnight. So make sure you throw your hat into the ring at tomwoods.com/gold as soon as possible. I will be announcing the winner on the show July 15th, 2015. That's episode 446. And we're not going to notify the winner in advance of that. Instead, I'm going to announce the winner before anybody knows about it, including the winner himself or herself. How about that? So it'll be exciting for everybody. You'll all be sitting there wondering who the winner is, and we'll all find out together. So that's going to be fantastic. Make sure you subscribe to the show on iTunes or Stitcher for free, of course, over at tomwoods.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next week.
The Tom Woods Show.